Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prastaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Iti Namine Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nevishesha Sunyavadi Paskatya Deshatarine. So before speaking, we always offer our respects to Srila Prabhupada, because without Srila Prabhupada as our guide, we would never ever be able to enter into or understand the mysteries of Vedic knowledge. There are so many books. You can go to a library and find hundreds and hundreds of books. Online you can find so many websites where they're discussing and trying to understand and analyze the Mahabharata or the conclusions of Bhagavad Gita. And people come to their own conclusions. I heard one distinguished lady speaker, and she was explaining that the five Pandavas were like fingers. They're the fingers. And Draupadi was like the palm of the hand. So she was explaining this was why Draupadi had to marry these five Pandavas, because the fingers have to be attached to the hand. So this was her understanding. And so many people, because there are countless people over countless ages, have their own interpretation and their own understanding. To some degree, perhaps it is truth, and to some degree, it is a relative understanding, which means it's relative to my capacity to understand this subject. So Srila Prabhupada, when he speaks, he also speaks as a human being, as well as being an empowered living being. He speaks as a human being. He speaks about when he was growing up in Calcutta. He sometimes tells a joke that the children used to tell, or the parents used to tell when he was a young boy, and he laughs. And sometimes he makes a mistake even, and says the wrong fact. He makes these things so that he appears, by his dealings, to be simply, for an ordinary person who has no training, he appears to be just an educated gentleman with some spiritual insightfulness and nothing more. But when we listen to him with care and we hear how true he is, how strong and firm he is, how fixed his faith is in the Vedic conclusions, in the Vaishnava Vedic conclusions, and how he doesn't waver. He doesn't say something like we will say something about Krishna, but then the next moment our thoughts turn to something else. They come down to another level of exchange. But Srila Prabhupada wasn't like that. In every exchange, practically, you could sense that underneath even a casual conversation, there was something very grave and very serious taking place. And therefore, even when you were sitting with him, perhaps he was relaxed, you were not fully relaxed, because you're not quite sure whether he would suddenly speak something that you would not be able to actually comprehend, something from a higher dimension of thought, something transcendental. So in the 1970s, we were all very young, obviously, and myself and my husband, we had been married for 6 years. When we have a millipede problem. When we met with Srila Prabhupada in Fiji, and at that time we had been married for 6 years, but our marriage had not yet become stable. And so Srila Prabhupada, judging the need for further practical advice, mixed with a sense of responsibility, he was instructing us and giving guidance to us on how to proceed. So at one point he was speaking specifically to me, and he was pointing out to me, after he had already said many things to both of us, that a wife's duty was to take instructions from her husband and nobody else. And by that he was referring to no other man. So he had his own specific point that he was trying to convey to us. And so he started to tell me the story of Sita Devi, and how Sita Devi was stolen by Ravana, and how Lord Ram, he could have created thousands of Sitas. He's a supreme lord. But for one Sita, he said, and he was speaking only to the two of us, and his eyes were very soft, very grandfatherly. It wasn't like a lecture. It was like a loving exchange. And he was looking at me because he felt I was the one who needed some shift. And so he said he could have created thousands of Sitas, but for one Sita, he was prepared to teach Ravana a lesson that the whole dynasty would be destroyed. The whole dynasty. So I was sitting and I was listening and I was trying to take in the message that I understood that he was giving to me. And then he said to me, these things have to be learnt. And he said, Ramayana and Mahabharata, they are there for the duty. Everyone's duty is there. Perfect duty. How to perform one's duty properly. So I don't know how you'd be feeling, but I was feeling terrible. I was thinking, how on earth can I ever perform my duty properly? It's not possible. And this morning I heard something that gave me a little, I wouldn't like to say I would feel happy to know I couldn't perform my duty properly, but to put it into a perspective, Srila Prabhupada was speaking about the importance of Varnashram. And how everything is there in the Mahabharata, it's all there, the ideal examples, how to behave. And then he suddenly said, but now it is all lost. Everything lost. And I felt it kind of was necessary for me to hear that, because when trying to transpose upon myself the ideal duty of Sita Devi, or of Draupadi, or Kunti Devi, then the gap, the disparity between my capacity and their ideal behavior was almost defeating, discouraging, because the gap was so wide. But why did he still want us to hear these, to hear these duties, even though we may never, ever, ever be in a position to be able to perform such ideal behavior? He wanted us to hear it because there has to be a standard. If there's no standard, then the army is lost. Just like you will hear, if you read Mahabharata, how each one of the generals who had their own armies, they had their own chariot, and everyone had a flag on top, and everyone's flag was different. And when Arjuna was fighting at Virat, he said to his driver, chariot driver, take me to where the flag is like this. And when he was saying the flag is like this, the flag is red, the flag has this markings on it, by mentioning the flag, he was mentioning the personality. Take me to see Bhishma Dev. I'm going to fight with him now. He would mention it by the flag. So in the Indian system, I beg your pardon, the English system of fighting in the medieval days, this word standard came into being. And what standard meant was, instead of having a chariot with a flag on top, they would have one man who would march with the army, and he had a very long pole. And on top of the pole, he had an insignia, like the flag. And he would march in those medieval times along with the army. And if the army got dispersed in some kind of a military difficulty, in order to recollect together and be strong, they had to look for the standard. And if they could see that, which was called the standard, they made their way somehow or other back to there. And what is very interesting to note was that the main business of the enemy soldier's main business, was to shoot the standard bearer. If you can kill him, the standard goes down, there's no standard anymore, they don't know where to go and how to reconnect. And the main business of the army themselves was to protect the standard bearer. Both of them were looking at the standard. So even though Vanashram is now lost and is not possible to artificially, how will you fit into society if you artificially try to imitate Vedic standards? But at the same time, they must be respected, and we must move as little or as quickly or somehow towards them, because those are standards of safety. These are standards of civilization. They're standards of proper behavior, not animal behavior. So Srila Prabhupada points out that now there is only one way, one standard. There is no other way, no other way. And of course we know what that standard is. Harinama, Harinama, Harinama Iva Kevalam. Kalua Nasteva, 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 Gatir Anyata. This is the standard. And yet, we adore to hear about these wonderful transcendental personalities. So let us continue. Yesterday we heard of the childhood of Kunti Devi. We heard how she called Suryadev, and she received a son, and she placed him in a beautiful boat and sent him down the river because she couldn't take care of him. And how she was always thinking of him. And then later she married, and she went to live in Hastinapur, and she was living royally, very beautiful palace, everything was very nice. And then her husband retired to the forest, and there was an accident, and he became cursed. And due to that curse, he moved higher up into the Himalaya mountains and took up the life of a real aesthetic yogi. And Kunti Devi also did the same thing. And then we heard how her sons were born, and they were born of devas. So they were not ordinary young boys. And how unfortunate as it was, Maharaj Pandu, he left this world when the boys were still young. And then, by Dhritarashtra's arrangement, in agreement with the sages, the boys were taken to live in the royal palace in Hastinapur. And then we heard the intrigue that began. Perhaps the boys were this size, this age. Just they were very innocent. They were very enthusiastic. They wanted to learn. They wanted to learn the military sciences and arts and so forth. But they had this rivalry between the cousins. And this rivalry was very, very deep. It was like inherent because it represented who was going to rule. And so as long as the Pandavas were there, the Kurus couldn't rule. And if the Pandavas were gone, then the Kurus would naturally rule. So it was inherent in everything, this rivalry. And then we heard how they grew up, how there were attempts even to assassinate them, and how they went back to the forest for some time and lived there incognito. And then once they were married now to Draupadi, they returned to Hastinapur with all the wealth of Maharaj Draupada behind them. And they had now met and contacted Krishna for the first time, and he had assured them, no matter what happened, he would protect them. So they returned. In Hastinapur, Dhritarashtra wasn't happy to see them. The Duryodhana and his brothers were very angry that somehow or other this had happened. But they tolerated them, and they made an agreement they could live in two halves of the kingdom. But Yudhisthira Maharaj, his part of the kingdom became so opulent and so wonderful that it clearly outweighed the glory of Hastinapur. And when he chose to perform the Rajasuya sacrifice, that would coronate him as the emperor of all the kings, the Raja Raj. And that would put him in a higher position than even the Kurus themselves. So we hear how he performed that sacrifice, and everything went very nicely for a short while. But then Duryodhana, intolerant of his cousins, he arranged a gambling match that was actually very, very dishonestly set up. And Yudhisthira, in a confusion And in a passion, he lost everything instantly. Everything he had that had built up and up and up, suddenly it was all gone. And then we heard how Draupadi was dishonored, brought to the court of the Kurus in such an ignoble way, in such an embarrassing way. And then they became so mad. Both sides became, in different ways, mad. And the Kauravas, incited by Karna, they asked to see her naked. And then Krishna came, he heard her pleas, and he came, and he manifested in the form of sari after sari after sari. They ripped off one sari, and it was gone, and another one was there, and another one was there. Different colors all piled up, till it was just a huge amount of cloth. And then, only after that, there were some very ill, ominous sounds, like jackals in the background, that convinced Dhritarashtra that something really bad had just taken place. Something really bad. And all those who had any common sense, or any culture, or any standards, already knew that the whole dynasty was finished now. This was going to be the end. Why? Because Duryodhan was unrelenting and Dhritarashtra was always in compromise with him. Even he knew he was doing the wrong thing. But the desire, the seed within his heart that he wanted what they wanted. He had always, from his childhood, wanted himself to be the king. So he was carrying a similar desire to his sons, although he would never have done any of the horrible things that they chose to do. And so he couldn't separate himself from them in times of urgent need. And therefore, because of this, the Pandavas were exiled. They traveled around. They went and lived in different forests. They lived in hermitages. They lived actually very, very peacefully. Because remember, they were born in the forest. They were used to living with sages. They loved the sages. Yudhisthira loved brahmanas. He loved to serve them, to hear from them, to take part in Vedic sacrifices. He loved this. So on one side, they were very happy. On the other side, it was like a time bomb. If you're carrying in your pocket a time bomb and it's going tick, 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 and it has 12 years on it, and at the end of 12 years it's going to explode. And Bhima wasn't happy. He just kept thinking of the Kurus and how he could destroy them, and sometimes he would tell Yudhisthira, just give me permission, I'll go right now, I'll kill them all. And Draupadi was still wearing her hair loose, which was unheard of in Vedic society. And there she was, and she was dressed like this so that Yudhisthira would not forget what had taken place. Nobody who saw her could forget what had happened. So Yudhisthira, on one side it was peaceful, but on the other side it was not peaceful at all. And he decided to send Arjuna to the heavenly planets to gain celestial weapons. Weapons that were unlike any weapons here on earth. Sometimes on the internet you will read articles or see some YouTube conversations where people say, you know, we have checked the soil in such and such a place and we find it is 10 times or 100 times more radioactive. So that means they had atomic bombs. Now we know what an atomic bomb can do. But they have, the scientists, and we ourselves also have no idea what these weapons could do. They made atomic bombs look like firecrackers. Such powerful weapons. Arjuna could kill en masse thousands and thousands of men in one moment. So for 5 years he spent studying, and he came back, he returned with many, many weapons that had never really been heard of, only Indra gave him his own special weapon, and these weapons the Kurus didn't have. The Kurus had some weapons because Drona was very powerful, but not as many weapons as Arjuna. And so they proceeded in different ways. And Duryodhana was always thinking, where are they? What are they doing? Sending his spies to find out what was happening. And eventually those 12 years passed. And the 13th year, the incognito year, at the beginning of that year, Yudhisthira Maharaj, he was in the forest, and one brahmana came running up to him in great distress, and he said, a deer just came by here, and he took my sacrificial instruments, the things that are used for the yajna, in his horns. He put his horns down, he took up my instruments, and he ran away with them. You have to go and find him. You have to go and find him and bring them back. So Yudhisthira Maharaj, being who he was, he set off to hunt this deer. And when he entered deep into the forest, in a very clever way, Yamaraj appeared to him. And Yamaraj spoke to him at that time. He was also in disguise. And he told him that now, for your 13th year, you should go and stay in the kingdom of Virat. And he assured him, he told him that even if none of you go in any disguise, even if you remain just as you are right now, and you go anywhere you want right now, no one will be able to find you. But go to the kingdom of Virat. And so Yudhisthira told the other Pandavas, and they all disguised themselves, and they went into Maharaj Virat's kingdom. Yudhisthira went as a courtier and a dice player. And he said, I will play with the king, and I will just sit and give him advice, something like a Brahmin, something like a person in the court. So he went in first, and the king was very happy to meet him, very happy to, could see immediately, he's extraordinary, he's so noble. Who is he? But anyway, you're welcome. So he came. Bhima came, and he came in with ladles in his hand, and he said, I would like to be in charge. I used to be in Yudhisthira Maharaja's kitchen, and I would like to take over your kitchen. So he came in like that. And Nakul came in. Arjuna came in as a eunuch, as a beautiful, third sex, as they call it, dressed in a skirt, with bangles right up his arm so that you couldn't see the marks of the archer marks. And he came in and he said, I would like to teach. I don't know how to dance. I would teach the princesses how to dance. And Maharaj Virat checked him very carefully and concluded that, yes, he was unusual. And so he said, yes, you can live with the princesses. So there he went. And Nakul, the horses, he wanted to take care of the horses. Sahadev, the cows, cattle. And then Draupadi came in as a maidservant, and she was a servant of the queen. And more or less that time went all right until just near the end, when there was another attempt to shame Draupadi, to take her in front of the king and mistreat her. And again Yudhisthira was unable to do anything. But Bhima, she came to Bhima in the night, and Bhima, he didn't even care that they were in hiding and disguised and they couldn't do anything. He immediately went and found that fellow and completely defeated him and smashed him. But the news that this person had been killed in such an extraordinary way through the spies, it immediately returned to Hastinapur. And Duryodhana thought, this is very interesting. This is what I've been looking for. I've been looking for some hint of where the Pandavas are, because if I find out where they are and if I capture them, if they come out of hiding, then they're back in exile for another 13 years. So he collected his armies and he went to Virat. But actually, as that battle took place between Duryodhana and Arjuna alone, Arjuna fought with all the Kauravas in such a way that they retreated. They couldn't fight with him. And they thought, according to their calculations, this was still within the 13 years. And Bhishma Dev told them, no, I've done the calculations, Domya has done the calculations, and the 13 years are now over. So you just had a taste of what it will be like when the Pandavas return to Hastinapur. So the Kurus returned to Hastinapur first, and Krishna came, and there were many, many discussions that took place from Virat as the Pandavas remained there. Now the king knew who they were, and he was willing to give them all support. And gradually they collected more people, and they had 7 Akshahinis of soldiers on their side. And Duryodhan took off immediately for Dwarka, thinking that he should try to get Krishna on his side. And simultaneously Yudhisthira told Arjuna, go to Dwarka and see Krishna. And so they both, as we know, they went in. Arjuna stood at his feet, Duryodhan by his side. Duryodhan came first, Arjuna second. And when Krishna woke up, he saw Arjuna and Duryodhan. And he said, what do you want? And then Duryodhan said, I want your support in the battle. And then he asked, what do you want? And Arjuna said, I want your support in the battle. And he said, yes. And so then he said, all right, because Duryodhan was becoming upset that why did you give him your permission first? Then he explained, one side, I will be there but not fighting, and the other, I will give my Akshahinis, the Narayan Akshahini, they will fight. Which do you want? Arjuna, which do you want? Arjuna, I want you. Duryodhan, which do you want? No problem. So Duryodhan went back happy, and Arjuna went back happy. And Krishna made so many arrangements to try to stop this battle still. And so did Kunti. So did Kunti. She went to see Karna. She went early in the morning because she knew that Karna, every morning he would do his oblations to the sun god, and he would do his worship, and then he would give away profuse charity to the brahmanas. And on this particular occasion, when he came out of the water from taking his bath, he looked and he saw there was just one lady there. And then he recognized this elderly lady to be the mother of the Pandavas. And then a very touching scene took place between them, where Kunti told him who she was, and told him who he was, who his father was, and why she had to let him go in that way. And she knew that by telling him this, she was going to put his whole life upside down. Because he was so bent on killing the Pandavas, he hated Arjuna so much. And now he was to find out that he was his brother. So she begged him, change sides. You can be, because it is the rule that the child before birth also takes the family of the father, you can be the sixth Pandava, please change sides. And at first Karna was confused and very emotional, but then he again realigned himself with Duryodhan and told her, he gave her one benediction. He said, I will not kill Yudhisthira. I will not kill Bhima. I will not kill Nakul or Sahadev. But I will kill Arjuna. And when I kill Arjuna, you will still have 5 sons. So Draupadi embraced him, knowing that she would never see him again. And she returned to the palace. And then the battle took place. And that battle is so ghastly. So ghastly that as you read about it, it's so ghastly that you can't even imagine. Bodies and men and animals and horses and elephants falling on top of each other, and chariots, till there was layer upon layer of bodies, and chariots driving over these bodies to get from one place to another place to commit another kind of a strategy. And this went on for how many days? 18 days. And each day there was a significant event that took place. And in the end, on the 18th day, after Duryodhan was hit below the waist by Bhima, and he was lying there, angry like a snake half killed, Ashvatthama went to the camp of the Pandavas and killed every last person who was there, which included the young sons of Draupadi. So in the end, there was about 5, 6, maybe 10 people left. 2 people, 3 people from the Kuru side, the Pandavas and 1 or 2 others. Nobody else remained after that battle. So can you imagine what a wonderful victory this would be? Arjuna foresaw it. And he spoke to Krishna and he said to Krishna, what's the use of winning a kingdom if the persons who we wish to win it for will die? Who will we share it with? How will I be happy? All my family will be gone. What's the value in this? Why are we fighting like this? What's the purpose of this? And as Krishna spoke to him the Bhagavad Gita, it became very clear that what Krishna wanted him to do was he wanted him to fight. He now wanted this battle to take place. He wanted the wholesale destruction of so many of these powerful Rakshasa-like kings. He himself had arranged for them all to come here by one way or another. So many powerful men. And he wanted them to fight. And he wanted them to die. And Arjuna was asked simply to become an instrument in this. An instrument in Krishna's plan. And Arjuna, because of his devotion and because of his clear-minded understanding of Krishna's will and who Krishna was, he accepted Krishna's instructions and he fought. And that battle took place. And it wasn't without grief. It wasn't that when Krishna wants something, this is a misconception we all share, I think perhaps you share with me, and certainly I have. And that is that, oh, Krishna only wants me to be happy. Krishna wants me to be happy. I think he probably wants you all to be happy as well, I hope so. But he certainly wants me to be happy. And so I do my devotional activities and the result will automatically be I'll be happy and hopefully you'll all be happy as well. And if you're not happy, then do a little more and then he'll make you happy as well and we'll all be happy. We'll be happy here in this world because Krishna will take away all the problems. Yes, he'll take away all the problems. We'll be happy. My family will be happy. We'll all be happy. And after that, we'll all go up to the spiritual world, which is better than heaven because it's forever. And there we'll be really happy. And it's all about me being happy. Spiritual life is all about me becoming happy. And this is something that we have to unlearn. We have to unlearn this. We have to understand that this is not what spiritual life is about. This is what Srila Prabhupada calls the path of punyavad. Now what does punya mean? Punya? Piety. Piety. So one level of the Mahabharata talks all about piety, the standard of how to live happily in this world by being pious. And yet, the Pandavas are the most pious, and they have the most suffering. So is this a mistake? Is this something went wrong here? Or could it be that they're suffering like this because they became devotees? Do you mean to say that if I become a devotee, Krishna will put me through the worst kind of suffering? This is a little scary. I was thinking before I was only going to get happiness. And now I'm reading this book and I'm starting to feel very nervous. Because, this is very scary. But both ways, we haven't actually become a very deep understanding. We haven't come to a deep understanding of what is actually taking place here. It is not that Krishna wants to make us unhappy. It is not that Krishna wants to make us happy here either. Because this place is certified by him to be a place of misery. Here, if I tell you all, this is poison, don't eat it. Please don't eat it, it's poison. I created it in the kitchen, it's poison. I'll even put a little fence around it, but it's sitting here in case any foolish person would like to try some, but it's poisonous, please don't eat it. You could say I'm quite unkind because I made something poisonous, but I warned you all, please don't take it. But it's there in this material world, in a better example, the material world is there so that we who prefer the material elements, we can have them if we want them. But Krishna warns, this is a place of sadness. You will all one day have to cry. Because one day those you love and what you love most, which is your body, will be taken from you. And when it is taken from you, then you will cry and you will feel great pain. And I don't recommend you to continue with this birth, death, birth, death, birth, death. I recommend you instead to find the path of dedication to me. So here I will show you how these great, great, great devotees, how they handle difficulty, how they handle tribulation, how they handle problems so much bigger than you will ever have to handle, hopefully. They're handling so much difficulty with their minds fixed on me. And as you meditate on them and you think about them and you remember their example, something of their qualities will come into your heart. Just like a crystal, right? You put a crystal next to a red rose. And the red rose, some of the qualities of the rose will be seen inside the crystal. So our heart is like the crystal. And when we put the crystal next to those of great souls, great personalities, their qualities enter into our heart. So please hear just a little bit. This is from another book, not from the Mahabharata, but this is from a wonderful story of Narada Muni, who meets the Pandavas. And he meets the Pandavas where they really live, which is not in Hastinapur, because the Pandavas are eternal servants of the Lord. So they live in the spiritual world. They come to this world, they perform pastimes here for the pleasure of Krishna, for the education of personalities like ourselves, but they exist eternally in the spiritual world. So Narada went to see them, and this is Hanuman telling Narada about the glories of the Pandavas before he visits them. He tells them why the difficulties came. Why did the difficulties occur? By sending poison and many other calamities, one after another, to trouble the Pandavas from their very childhood. By sending these things, sending one problem after another, the Lord deliberately showed their determination, their religion, their fame, their wisdom, their devotion, and their ecstatic love. Their ecstatic love. Now, love means two. Love doesn't mean one. If you love somebody, the love, real love, is always in exchange. So, as the invisible super soul, the Lord arranged for the Pandavas to undergo many troubles. He did this, however, only to broadcast their glories forever throughout the world. The Lord's pure devotees never perish, and what seems to be their sufferings in this world is only for their benefit and their glorification. What seems to be their sufferings, what we identify immediately, instantly as sufferings, if that was happening to me, that would be horrible. When that's happening to them, it's something completely different. And this is very important. This dimension of the Mahabharata is very important to gain, along with the human standard ethical lessons that are there as well for us. So what did he do? He put them through all these difficulties. And he acted as their servant. He served them. He brought things for them. He used to go at night, especially after Abhimanyu was killed. He went to the tent where Arjuna was staying. He laid down his bed for him. He made every arrangement for when Arjuna would come into the room. He took care of him. He was with him. He encouraged him. This is Krishna serving Arjuna, not Arjuna serving Krishna. He served them. He was with them as their friend. He served them as a servant, an advisor, messenger, charioteer, and even as a court attendant. Krishna, bring this. And he's coming and bringing it. Now, wouldn't we like that? Krishna, bring this. Krishna, fix up my family problem. Krishna, fix up this. I have a headache today. Krishna, fix this up. But there's no love there. There's only pure selfishness in our hearts. Give me, give me, give me, give me. I am the center. But their love is so strong for him. It binds him to reciprocate in the same way. They'll do anything for him, and he'll do anything for them. Not only did Krishna look after the Pandavas as the invisible super soul, which means guiding them from within at every moment, but he dealt with them in various public exchanges of love. Sometimes he drove Arjuna's chariot more than once. Not only on Kurukshetra, he drove Arjuna's chariot when he went to protect the Kandava forest when Agni wanted to burn it. Then too, Krishna drove Arjuna's chariot. In Yudhisthira's court, he sat as the head of the assembly of advisors, and sometimes he anticipated their wishes, and he gave them personal counsel and carried messages for them. Sometimes he would stand guard all night with a sword in his hand. This is love. This is love. This is what every living being is missing in their life. This is what everybody is looking for in every single act that they perform. Trying to find this, the missing element in their lives, trying to fill up the vacancy with one thing after another. But this love can only be reciprocated purely with Krishna. Because Krishna can reciprocate totally with us as who we really are, and not as aging or young bodies. So out of his affection and concern for them, what would the Lord not do? He was seen taking combined roles of servant, companion, and dearmost friend. And they took the same roles for him. So Kunti Devi knows this. She also knows the human-like grief that human beings experience in this life, in this world. She also knows that. She also sets the example of completely surrendering and depending on Krishna, even in the most difficult personal situations. But the real gift of the Mahabharata, and the real gift of Bhagavad Gita, and the real gift of the Srimad Bhagavatam, is to understand our intimate relationship with Krishna, and use this life as if it were a battle of Kurukshetra, with all its ups and downs, and use this life to develop this relationship, this special personal relationship that each one of us shares with Krishna. Sri Radharaman Prabhu, you've got the look of somebody who's keeping time. 10 minutes. Okay. Do we have any questions or any comments? Yes.
I think I read in the introduction of the Bhagavad Gita that although Duryodhana knew that Krishna was God, did Duryodhana know that Krishna was God?
Yes. Everybody knew who Krishna was.
So did also the people that Krishna would serve, did they know that Krishna was God as well?
They knew and they didn't know, because love is higher than... It's like if your brother became the president of America, you would know he's president of America. Everyone would tell you, so you know. But when you're dealing with him in affection, it would be less important. Mostly it would be the brotherly relationship. So the Pandavas knew, and the same way everybody knew he's the supreme unlimited Lord, but they still had their own interests in the foreground. So we know also, right? But we have our own interest in the foreground. That's our problem. That's what we're trying. That's our battle of Kurukshetra, to shift that so that we have Krishna's interest in the foreground. What were you going to say?
One Goswami in Vrindavan said that Well, he thought that Radharani is supreme and Krishna is Radharani's servant. And he said Radharani is supreme because Krishna does seva for her. But I said how, like, Arjuna was, Krishna drove Arjuna's chariot in the Mahabharata and revealed that Krishna is God. So, and he still drove Arjuna's chariot.
The thing is that according to the mood of a devotee, for example, someone may be in the mood of a devotee of in Vatsalya Ras, then they think, oh, look at Mother Yasoda. There's nobody superior to Mother Yasoda. Or look at Devaki Mother. She was gave birth to Krishna. What could be greater than that? And then the cowherd boys who are in a fraternal friendship relationship, they think, you know, I climb on his shoulders. When I defeat him, he has to carry me. What can be greater than that? And each person has their own mood of love according to the nature of their love. So someone may say, oh, Radharani is higher. Oh, Arjuna is higher. Oh, this person is higher. Yes, yes. But this is actually an expression of love. It's not an expression of fact. It's an expression of love. You can say fact, but it's an expression of love. Anything else?
How did the Mahabharata get passed down over 5,000 years? Like, the Mahabharata they were reading the book, wrote it, like, how is it? They know what.
Okay. So Vyasadeva, he put together the Mahabharata. There's actually a Mahabharata on the heavenly planets. There's a Mahabharata on the earthly planet, and there's a Mahabharata on the Asuric planet. I don't know what that one is like. I do know that there's a village in, my son was telling me, there's a village in, near the, it may be in Punjab, near the Himalaya mountains, where they all worship Duryodhana. And you can't have it's Ravana. They worship Ravana, that's right. And you can't have a Dussehra there. If you have Dussehra there, then something bad happens to someone in your family. Because there they all love Ravana. So there's everything in India. But so there's a Mahabharata. I think there's 100,000 verses for the Mahabharata on this, for the earthly plane. 600,000 verses in the heavenly planets, and then there's another 75,000, I think, in the on the Asuric region. And these have been, they're like eternal. They're spoken, but they remain within society. So initially they were spoken, and someone would tell, and they spread by word of mouth. So you can understand, of course, with spreading by word of mouth, some inaccuracies may be there. But the essence remains the same. So sometimes something on the outside gets a little bit disturbed, but this essential mood of the heroic nature of the Pandavas and the glory of Bhagavad Gita and Krishna's supreme position, this has been passed down from generations and generations for thousands of years. And just at the beginning of Kali Yuga, Vyasadeva, he compiled this into the verses. Over 2 million characters in the Mahabharata. 2 million letters in the whole composition. So from then it has been spoken from a text. And the text, again, sometimes it is adjusted or changed or altered one way or another. So some texts are considered more authentic than others. But this is how the Mahabharata remains within human society. Yes and yes.
Yeah. Is there any explanation of the previous lives of the sons of Draupadi? Why they were...
There is, but I can't remember this.
I know about Abhimanyu, yeah. He was previously the son of the Chandra.
Yes.
So in the Chandra, the wind was ordered, yes, to appear on the earth, he was reluctant, but then he said, yes, okay, only 15 years or 14,
yes,
years, he said, okay,
yes,
we'll live a while.
Yes.
So that's what he was destined to.
Yes. The Pandava's sons, I can't remember. Oh, that's another thing that I think is really difficult for us, or at least I should say, or be more honest and say difficult for me. In my upbringing, which is a Western one, so it may be different for somebody who has sanskars from India, but that I see life as going in a straight line like this. You get born, you grow up, this happens, and then you die. Like the Changing Bodies exhibition. And then it's sort of over. So you've got to fill it, get in as much as you can, because at the end it's over. So what's the use? So try for as much pleasure and enjoyment as you can. Whereas the Vedic one was secular. And I was thinking this morning, it's very strange that we think like this, because we look all around us and we see cycles. We see cycles in the seasons, we see cycles in the days, we see cycles in the hours of the day, day and night. Everywhere, everything is going round and round in circles. So at the end of the Mahabharata, when Kunti Devi and Gandhari are still lamenting so much the loss of so many family members, Vyasadeva tells them, come with me, and he brings them to the bank of the Ganga, and then he says, you will see them all again. And then they're sitting there waiting, and then at a certain point there's a whole din, a whole lot of noise, like a lot of people, and they all come out, they all enter out of the Ganga, and they have no animosity towards each other. They're all friendly, Karna is friendly, everybody is there. So again, for us as materialists, we think, oh, fantastic, heaven's going to be happy ever after, I've got to keep moving forward. But actually, the real lesson is that all of this is sort of like a game. It's all like illusory. So don't just forget about it, therefore, but use every moment of this dreamlike existence to get to the other side of this samsara, or this cycle of birth and death, happiness and distress, round and round, round and round. So all of the, there it's revealed who everybody was, why they were fighting the way they were. And it, to me, I felt a little anticlimactic, because I was getting really angry with the bad people and really proud of the good ones, and then, oh, was all taken away. And then it starts again. And this is how actually the life and existence in the material world is arranged. And we're very small, very, very small, so we see a little part of it. Like if a kangaroo was to run past those windows, we would see the kangaroo run past the windows, but we wouldn't know where he went there or where he was before. We don't know those things. We only know what we saw. So therefore, the Mahabharata, it expands our understanding, so we can see from a very vast perspective what life in this world is like, what it is meant for, how it can be useful, and what is actually the purpose of life.
Well, Ashwatthama's qualification for him to be Vyasadeva in the next year.
In that cycle, we're talking about the cycle round and round and round, there's a purification that goes on. See, in this one, like this, I'm born a bad person and I stay a bad person, because I was born a bad person, I die a bad person, pretty much. I might get a bit of improvement, but that's how I came, that's how I'll be. But in the Vedic time formation, so Ashwatthama did so many horrible things, and so therefore he got condemned to stay. He didn't die. He doesn't die. Everyone else dies. He wanders and wanders and wanders with the injury from the removal of the jewel, and he just stays alive through all of Kali Yuga. And sometimes his special people say, oh, I saw Ashwatthama somewhere or another. But he stays alive. But in this way, he becomes purified by the cycle. And then when he's purified, then he takes a high position again. So the same way, we also can become purified by the cycle of our life, and we also can reach to very high positions. It's not impossible. So this is on a grand scale, we're on a small scale. The purification is going on, and Srila Prabhupada said, an intelligent person is always considering what they're doing. Is this going to take me up, or will this take me down? This is a sign of intelligence. If it will take me up, I'll do it, because I want to purify my consciousness. Janeshwari, last one. Yes.
With regards to Mother Kunti, did she develop her mood of self-surrender towards Krishna due to the difficulty that she was faced with during that era, or was it something that's always existed? Because the question comes up in my mind was, if she had that mood of surrender towards Krishna all along, why was she fearful when she had karma?
Because the Leela takes place on different levels at the same time. So there's an eternal aspect. And then there's a lila aspect, a human aspect. So she, yes, she's an eternal associate of Krishna. But at the same time, it doesn't mean that she's always, by his arrangement, in that consciousness. So she's enacting, going through on the human level. But at the same time, she has this eternal relationship with him. It's difficult to understand, but the only thing we have to refer to is Arjuna. When he's bewildered and doesn't want to fight, but he's eternally with Krishna, yet at the same time, for Krishna's arrangement, he's in a position of bewilderment for some time. And in that bewilderment, we can identify with him. We can't identify with him in his perfection, but we can identify with him in his bewilderment. So in similarly with Kunti Devi, just a little bit of an answer for you.